from KQED. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos from KQED's politics team.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, KQED's politics editor. And today on The Breakdown, it has been a week of tears, anger, protest in Sacramento, culminating Thursday with the funeral of Stephon Clark.
Yeah, we're going to dedicate the show really to this issue today of police shootings. Stephon Clark is 22 years old, was shot and killed by Sacramento police in his grandmother's backyard about 2 weeks ago. They thought he had a gun, they say, but it turned out he only had a cell phone. We'll get into sort of the bigger issue of police shootings in a bit. But first, we have our Sacramento politics reporter, Katie Orr, on the line from up there. Hey, Katie.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
So, Katie, you've been out there all week at the protest. You were at the funeral today. You live in Sacramento. And can you kind of just paint a picture of what it's been like up there and kind of what it feels like as a member of the community?
It's been a tense time up here. I mean, especially for the African-American community, just listening to them at the meetings and at the rallies, they're tired of this and they're scared. I think that's the thing that's really stuck with me. You hear a lot of, is my son next? Is my daughter next? Am I next? You know, they don't trust the police and they're angry. There have been a lot of raucous protests. But today at the funeral, it was more about the grief. I mean, people were really, they lost someone that they cared about a lot. And hundreds of people turned out for this today. They let 500 in the church and then they were at capacity and there were still a couple hundred outside. It was a massive turnout.
And Katie, I know you were at the city council meeting on Tuesday night when the brother of Stephon Clark, Stevante Clark, came to the front of the room and sat right in front of the mayor, Daryl Steinberg. And he had today at the funeral as well. He came up and sort of took over and started talking about his brother. And I want to play a clip from Reverend Al Sharpton, who was there, who spoke and said this right after Stephonte Clark spoke.
You don't tell people in pain how to handle their pain. You don't tell people when you kill their loved one how to grieve.
And Katie, that was really speaking, I think, to those who may have seen the grief and the way it was expressed and think it was somehow inappropriate, right?
Yeah, I think so. And you heard that sentiment echoed earlier this week at the city council meeting because from an outside perspective, Stevante's behavior looked a bit erratic, you know, chanting, but then becoming really somber, then making, you know, really valid points about the disparity in Sacramento between the rich and the poor, the black and the white communities. But people at that meeting as well were saying, you know, he's grieving. This is his way of getting this out. His brother was just shot. And I think we see it too with the family. You know, they're really open to the media, but it's gotten so much attention that I think it's become pretty overwhelming for them.
Yeah, I bet. And I mean, God, you can't tell anybody after losing a family member like that how to feel. You know, I think one of the things that is interesting, I mean, there's so much about the shooting. I think the body cam footage has helped sort of draw attention to what happened so quickly. And we've also seen protesters really, I think, use some smart tactics to draw attention. They shut down two Kings games, essentially. And then we've seen the Kings actually engage some promises to put money behind a Black Lives Matter group up there. What are you seeing in terms of how effective this protest has been?
Well, I think it has been effective. They are changing the conversation. There is a group up here who was saying, a community group of activists saying, we want this to become a movement, not just a moment. And so they're trying to think of ways to have lasting impact. I spoke to Mayor Daryl Steinberg today and asked him what he thought about this. And he said, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes there are things that matter more than the bottom line. He did give credit to the Kings and the police for largely letting protesters just do what they're going to do at the games and through the city as well. He says, particularly the police, if they had gotten more involved, Steinberg believes there would have been a riot. And so he says that the police department handled it very well and that the Kings, in stepping up and supporting the protesters and the family, are handling it well also.
It's interesting. Daryl Steinberg, of course, has been mayor for maybe a couple of years at most. He was Senate President Pro Tem in the Senate for several years. And I'm wondering if you've had a chance to talk to him about, you know, the change in role and what it's like to be now mayor, and his thoughts about some of the efforts that failed at getting some legislation passed around police reform when he was there.
Yeah, I did. And he said that in his mind, bottom line, police groups have to be more open to transparency. I asked him if he thinks these groups need less power. He says he doesn't see it that way. There's a place in politics for every side. You know, that's how you get good policy, going back and forth. But he said the balance is off right now, and it swings too much in favor of the police groups. And we have seen their power over the years, multiple bills aimed at body cameras and release of police investigations, things
personnel
of that
files,
nature.
Yeah.
Personnel files, exactly. Those have all died. We have seen just recently some bills that will be coming up again, one from Nancy Skinner that would allow public access to police investigations on things like discipline relating to deadly and serious use of force, sexual assault against civilians, perjury, those kinds of things. Also, Assemblyman Kevin McCarty, who is from here in Sacramento, is reviving his bill that was killed last fall, which would allow independent investigators in some cases to take over these investigations into police shootings in some cases. That bill last year was watered down and then eventually killed.
Right. And interestingly, some of the watering down was supported by the attorney general, who actually stepped in quickly to say he would investigate this shooting. Just before we let you go, Katie, can you just give us a sense of what the mayor's been saying more broadly about this shooting and kind of what needs to happen? I mean, he is the leader of the city and he does oversee the police department.
Yeah, and he was telling me that he thinks Sacramento really can be a model in dealing with these kinds of situations. He points to the fact that the chief of police asked the attorney general to oversee their investigation. The attorney general didn't approach them, and that they released the body cam footage, which the Sacramento Police Department has been criticized for in the past, not releasing tapes in similar situations. So he is saying that they are trying to push for transparency and that it's difficult, but he thinks this is a moment where the city can really come together and unify as opposed to splintering.
Thank you so much, Katie. Great work this week. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, coming up next, we're going to talk a lot more about those issues. We'll be joined by Oakland attorney John Burris. He has been suing police departments over civil rights issues and excessive force for decades. You are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, along with Marisa Lagos. We're devoting the entire show today to the shooting death of Stephon Clark by Sacramento police. Certainly one of the big stories dominating the news this week. And joining us now, Oakland civil rights attorney John Burris. He has represented many victims, as Marisa said, of excessive police force, from Rodney King to the families of Oscar Grant, who, of course, was killed by BART police, and Mario Woods, who was shot and killed by the SFPD. John Burris, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for coming.
Let me ask you, first of all, how would you grade the city of Sacramento as you've seen this unfold from the shooting, and then in particular after the shooting, in terms of the mayor, the police department, and how it's unfolding so far?
Well, first off, I have to tell you that I've had a lot of experience with Sacramento PD. I have found them to be, in the more recent cases that I've had, to be progressive, thoughtful, willing to change. Surprisingly, they have come to the table in cases that I've had. So it's not surprising to me that the present mayor, as well as the police chief there, are interested in improving the situation and being in control and being responsive and transparency, because those are the issues that we have been talking about, and they have agreed to it. So in that sense, I look very favorably upon the police and the police chief and the mayor's office. The thing that I really get that was really good is on the question of how do you control the protesters. Because what we have had in Oakland and with all the protests in San Francisco, we've had anarchists, people who would they'd be good protesters, and then the anarchists would come in and take advantage of it. Well, I haven't seen that at all in Sacramento.
I was thinking about that, too. It's interesting.
It seems to be that these are people of the community who are expressing themselves, and they're not out to destroy anything. They just want to be heard. And the police allowing that to occur, ostensibly you're getting cooperation because you're not breaking things down, you're not hurting people. So in that sense, I think the police have been good in allowing people to express themselves under a situation that is outrageous, that on its face, you know, notwithstanding whether the police, whatever the police thought they may have thought at the time, the point is there's a young man that's dead, and he was unarmed, and he was shot 20 times. Those are things that will cause people to go crazy and think that the system itself is reckless in its evaluation of African-American lives. And so this fact pattern has sort of opened up these wounds that people carry around almost in a paranoid state all the time. I'm always giving lectures to kids, young men, about being careful. Watch what you do with your hands. Watch what you are. Police are not out to get you, but they will get you. And if you step out of line in any kind of way or give the wrong impression, you, in fact, can be shot and killed like this case. I don't believe this young man came at them with his arm extended to suggest in any way he was trying to do harm. If anything, he was trying to show them that I got a cell phone. And that's why it's him. But it was misinterpreted.
So, yeah, I mean, when you, I guess, hear about this case, see this body cam footage, I mean, what strikes you about this? It was dark in that footage. The police were out looking for somebody who had basically been accused of vandalism. So there was no report of a weapon. Right. I mean, but what is your sort of initial impression knowing what we do know at this point and understanding that more is probably to come out?
Well, obviously more has come out, and I haven't had a chance to analyze the data in the way that I normally would. But you have a situation to me that you obviously are looking for someone who is committing some mischievous type work. That's not normally a deadly force kind of scenario.
Right.
So then you have the officers. It is dark. What troubled me the most about this is that they were in a position of safety and a person's coming toward them. There was nothing about that would suggest that he was armed with a weapon. He put his hand up. Obviously, he was trying to show that he had a cell phone because he was told me, show me your hands. So from my point of view, I thought that that the police should not have left the position of safety at the time and then fired whatever reasons.
We know there's going to be at least one or two autopsies. The city, the county will do one, and I think there's an independent one also. What are you going to be looking for? What do you look for in those autopsies?
Well, I tell you, I have to give second autopsies often, but I also go and photograph the body immediately and to see where the entry and exit wounds are, because that will tell you a lot about it. So one of the things you want to find out is how close was the person? Are there any smoke from the gun that's nearby, suggested within a couple of feet? You want to see where the entry and exit wounds are. But it's not as concerning to me in this case about the autopsy, because we know he was shot multiple times, and we know he wasn't shot like within a foot or two. So that's not really the question of this. He's dead.
If it's found that, say, he got shot in the back.
Well, that's different.
Is that different?
Oh, absolutely. So you're looking to see where the entry and exit wounds are. If a person is shot straight on and it's tattooed around the chest area, that's one thing. On the other hand, if the person shot in the back multiple times, that may suggest that he was in a different position. Now, I will tell you this, you can get shot and get spun around. And so that's not conclusive. But it is the kind of thing that, as a lawyer, you want to know. The second thing you want to know is what kind of drugs are on board. If there is alcohol, if there's drugs, because if there's a substantial amount of drugs on board, that might explain erratic behavior. So that a person who knows you don't present yourself in a negative way toward the police may not appreciate that if they're under the influence of mind-altering drugs such as methamphetamine or cocaine or something that might affect that. So I'd want to know all of that. So that's part of what you're trying to do is, first, let's find out what the physical evidence is. The autopsy and the drug are part of the physical evidence. And once you get that, then the next thing I would do, if I didn't do that initially, I would take the video and go through and slow it down, enhance it, give it to a professional, which people I have on that work for me, so I get a better position of knowing what the officer actually saw so that I can see and make some assessment. Was it reasonable for him to believe that? Then, because the question is, what was this sight? This was a silver item. Did it look like a gun? Did it offer a glint? And what was the position of the person's hands? How fast did those hands move? Did they move up really quickly so that you can misinterpret that? Or was it shown in such a way with palms out to show you that, look, this is, I got a cell phone? Because what an officer wants to know, where are your hands?
Right.
That's the first thing they want to know. Where are your hands?
So you're talking about having video of this. And as somebody who's been working on these types of cases for decades, I mean, it seems like body cam, social media have really changed the game, both for folks in terms of, you know, the sort of social impact of these shootings, but also for the cases. I mean, is that really why you think this moment is coming right now, where we're seeing these protests?
Well, absolutely, because look, I was involved in many substantial beatdown cases before Rodney King. But the vast majority of the world did not know of those kind of beatings by a police officer.
Rodney, your first, when you were a prosecutor, you had a case, right?
Where I was a prosecutor, I had cases. But Rodney King, I was a defense lawyer at the time. I was a plaintiff counsel. So that was really the first case that I had that was a video camera. There was a case that I did, Melvin Black.
You remember
that? Okay. Yeah, that was one of my first foray into police stuff, but there was no video camera. Rodney King was the first video camera that was there that showed the complete beating. I will tell you that videos are substantial game changers. It doesn't necessarily end the story, but it gives you a contemporaneously look at the time that can be extraordinarily helpful. And so it can be helpful to the plaintiff, or it could be detrimental. I think that cameras are good for both the police and for the plaintiff, because I have walked away from cases when I've seen the video camera that demonstrates that I thought the police officer's conduct was proper. On the other hand, I've stayed in cases where I saw the camera and say, wait a minute, how do you justify that?
Right.
So cameras are important.
So that's one distinction I want to talk to you about, which is, I think, you know, for these protesters, in a lot of cases, the only real justice would be prosecution of the police. But there's also just the issue of whether they're following policy and whether they should be police officers, right? I mean, they could be not prosecuted but still be disciplined. I mean, can you kind of explain, like, what's the distinction there?
Well, the real distinction is this. The fundamental, to prosecute a police officer, you need evidence to demonstrate as proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's extraordinarily difficult.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. Is that for the jury, or is that for the DA to press charges?
Well, arguably it's for the jury, but the DA will say that I'm not going to bring the case unless I'm convinced that I can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Prosecuting police are very difficult. And I've been involved in countless cases I have sent to the DA. I've been very disappointed by their failure to prosecute these cases. But I also understand when we have tried to prosecute a case, we didn't do well. That was in the Oscar Grant case. And so, but I'll go back to the other point. Yes, you can be disciplined. You could have violated the practices of a department and still not get prosecuted. Or you can be found responsible in a civil case, which are the cases I'm involved in, and not be punished and not be prosecuted. So there are different levels. But I'm going to tell you one point that's more important in all of this. And that is, you want to look down the road to see if there was a violation of a policy, or if the policy was inappropriate, that you need to rewrite the policies so that you then can have some effect on future conduct. The most important case I can tell you all is the Ryder's case that we involved in Oakland.
Yeah, can you explain to folks who may not be familiar?
Yeah, at least four guys who engaged in a course of improper police conduct. We got a federal judgment, and then we got what they call a negotiated settlement agreement. But the important part is that we were able to rewrite the policies of the department, to retrain the officers on them, and then to find out if they're in compliance with that. It's taken a long time.
And do you think Oakland's better?
Oakland is substantially better. But for the sex case that happened a couple years ago, we would have been on the right track. The sex case got us off, because now we're doing a lot of work on the racial profiling question, procedural justice questions, how do you talk to people, consistency of discipline, the internal affairs. It's a revamping of the department. Unfortunately, it's taken a long time to get it done, and it wasn't done with a lot of ease. It took time.
Other than getting the attention of the police department and of the media, what are these big settlements mean for a police department?
Well, what it should mean is for the city. The city is a question of risk management. And if a department is really good and thoughtful, they should look at settlements and or jury verdicts as a way to evaluate what they did wrong. The worst part of of this scenario. If they say, we got those because of John Burris or other lawyers like us, without really looking to see why that happened. Because you should take advantage of a department, a police department, city, should evaluate what were the fact patterns that existed within that particular case that got that large judgment or that large jury verdict, and determine whether or not the policies that we had in place at the time were appropriate or not. Or the policies might have been fine, but the officer did not act consistent with the policies. And so there's great, it's up to the department themselves to look into themselves to see whether or not it's something that policies they have and or whether or not the officers themselves did not follow those policies.
What brought you to this work specifically? Was there a case? Was there a moment?
Well, you know, I'm old enough to being a person who observed the civil rights movement as a kid.
You grew up in Vallejo, right?
I grew up in Vallejo, and I was, although Vallejo wasn't necessarily affected by the civil rights movement, I saw on television and I was able to see how law enforcement mistreated and misused people, and I could not relate to that. Then ultimately I was in Chicago, and believe it or not, when real police brutality was taking place, not of the recent vintage, and it stuck a chord with me. And I have been a civil rights person and believing in civil rights issues my entire professional life. And I just happened to get caught up in the police issues because, I'll tell you, the most despised person in my experience in the whole system is an African-American male. And I've become their champion because I know that if you don't have a champion, you will get misused in this system. And so that's why the people are upset, because young men, and I'm upset because I see young men being killed and on a consistent basis, arbitrarily, sometimes I think without just cause. They may not be the best person in the world, but there's nothing about what happened under circumstances justified the killing of them. So it's a deep-seated issue with me, and I have lawyers who work for me, they feel the same way.
I bet. I mean, I'm curious, though, one of the things I've noticed in, you know, some of the Oakland and San Francisco cases, not just around police shootings, but around racial profiling, misconduct, is that it's not just the white officers doing it.
Oh, absolutely.
And I just, what is it? Is it the culture of power? I mean, how do you explain that?
I view it as there's an implicit racial bias in the culture of a department. And that's how they do business. That, and I'm not calling names. I'm saying that's what has happened historically in a department. You come into that department as a young officer, black or white, you can buy into that culture. And you then see things through the perspective of that culture. So, in Oakland we found, you know, as we started gathering data and looking at some of the tapes, the procedural justice tapes, we saw that black officers frequently will behave toward black people and as much the white people do.
Yeah.
And so it's the culture of the department that you are trying to change, and you're trying to weed out this whole notion that you have to look at ethnic groups in a certain way. One of the things I do when I talk to young people who want to be officers, I say, look, you need to learn the culture. This is white young guys. You need to learn the culture of the community in which you are going to serve. Mm-hmm. Just because a black person has his pants hanging down or he has a certain thing, that doesn't mean they're a bad person. You need to know that culture and know the language of the culture, the walk of the community, so that you're in a better position to make assessments, and you may not be as frightened by the differences, because it's the differences that will cause you to overreact to a given situation.
You've been doing this for almost 40 years. Not,
absolutely.
And I'm wondering, I don't know how many cases like this, the Stephon Clark one, the Rodney King, the Riders, how many of those you've done, but I'm wondering, do you feel like it takes a toll on you personally as an African-American male? The emotion, I mean, we saw it today at the funeral, but every family goes through this, well, whether or not they rise to the level of media attention.
Look, it's hurtful to me. When I go to a funeral and see young black men dead, it's hurtful to me. I did this case yesterday where a 32-year-old man was shot and killed, shot three times in the back by the Vallejo PD. It's painful to me. It's hurtful to me because that's a life that's destroyed. And the collateral damage of the death is what I don't think is appreciated, because it does affect the children, the grandparents, the mothers, the fathers, the uncles, and it affects the stability of the family, the harmony of a family. So I got it. I mean, I know that these things stretch beyond, and I've seen the pain on the mothers and the pain on the grandparents, and I go to these, and I go to the funerals, but more importantly, and so therefore, I become their champion, because I feel very strongly that we cannot, someone has to stand up or as John Lewis would say, make them uncomfortable. I may not be able to win, but I want you to be very uncomfortable because you just can't kill this person and think nobody's going to care about it. And that's why I find that the cameras are so important, or the press conferences that we have. Because if you don't, police will give a statement out saying this is how it happened.
Yeah.
But if you don't have someone that says, no, it didn't happen that way, then the people are felt the pain and no recourse. And so I'm their champion in many ways.
So what makes, I mean, we've talked about the cameras and maybe that's it, but why, I mean, the Vallejo case you just mentioned, it's been in the press, but it's not, there's not protest out there. That man was shot in the back. I mean, what's the difference, do you
think?
Well,
some of the difference is who the person is to some extent, but more importantly, the cameras do play a big part, and the egregiousness of the circumstances. Look, I did a case up when I was talking about in Sacramento. A homeless guy gets chased down by Sacramento PD. He's shot down. Okay? We do this case. It gets some public attention around there. This is on camera, right? This mm-hmm. is camera. But there wasn't. Sacramento people didn't come out in great protest.
Right.
They didn't come out. Now, he was a 45-year-old homeless guy, you know, and wasn't doing it. But the difference here, this is a young man.
In his grandmother's backyard. I think
location and stuff counts. Yeah. And so he's at home. He's at his place. Now, all the actual facts of that case, we don't really know yet. That might give a different scenario, but that's what the lawyers have to do. And sometimes, unfortunately, the community is not ready for the actual facts of a case. You know, that part, it becomes a challenge because they know that the homicide has taken place, but they don't really appreciate the nuances of what a police officer's rights are.
We have just a little over a minute left, but I want to ask you, you know, as you sit here and once again we're having this conversation about a police shooting, do you feel optimistic or do you really feel despair?
No, I don't feel despair. Look, I look at this in a historical context. Every generation has to move the social justice chain forward. And it has always been that way. There's going to be some people who are going to move it. Things are going to happen that will cause it to move. And so I don't feel despair. I feel that this is just my time. There will be others, the lawyers that I'm training now, it will be their time to move it along. And I don't, and before me, there were lawyers that I understood and looked at, that respected, that helped move me and move the social agenda. So, no, I just figure that it's a matter of historical significance, that people have to participate when it's their time to do it. And when you do what you can do, then you move over and the next person steps up.
Well, we're going to end it on that optimistic note. Civil rights attorney John Burris, thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That will do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Katie Orr is our politics reporter in Sacramento, our producer, Guy Marzorati, and our engineer today, Seal Muller. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is our vice president of news.
I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @MLagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Schaefer.
That's a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We will see you next time.
Bye-bye.